The crucial issue of impeachment and whether or not historical precedent should be an important consideration was the subject of a debate last week at the University of Minnesota. The speakers were history professor Paul L. Murphy and Professor Clyde W. Summers of the Yale Law School. Murphy argued that past history should have a direct bearing on impending proceedings against Mr. Nixon, while Summers contended that history doesn't matter since current circumstances are unique. First, Professor Paul Murphy.
When President-elect Peter McGraw was visiting the campus during the recent presidential search, I made it a point to check out his various books, and among others, his basic textbook on American government, which is widely used in this country. And reading through it, I came across an interesting statement that, and I'm quoting, as a result of the Andrew Johnson impeachment fiasco, impeachment as a viable constitutional device was demonstrated to be a rusty blunderbuss which will never be used again. I said to Mr. McGraw when he was here, as a professor of government, that statement shows that you know a lot more about history than about political science. And his response was, well, at least political scientists can learn from history, and I've already revised that section for the next edition. Certainly when Mr. McGraw's book was published in 1965 originally, the serious possibility of impeaching a president was, of course, highly remote. However, one of the most impressive aspects of our constitutional history, I think, has been the amazing, foresightful array of tools which our founding fathers put in the constitutional toolbox for later generations to work with. And while some of these tools do indeed get rusty from non-use from time to time, the historical circumstances for which they were collected do have a way of recurring. The historic purpose of impeachment and of the impeachment tool is, I think, quite clear, and if it's used to fulfill that historic purpose, I think there's no question that our constitutional system can be put back into good working order. However, I am disturbed by current attempts to twist that instrument or blunt the tool or, for that matter, break the tool, which Mr. Nixon's lawyers especially seem to be out somewhat deliberately to do. As Mr. Nixon's activities have become clearer to the American people in recent months, people have begun scrambling, as you know only too well, to find what history shows us regarding that device. Unfortunately, some people have already begun scrambling to try to twist history in order to achieve certain kinds of partisan ends from that particular process. What it seems to me remains to be seen is whether an accurate application of historical principles is ultimately adhered to, or whether modern lawyers or congressmen or senators ultimately twist history and the meaning and intent of historical processes to accomplish a modern end which to them is more immediately self-serving. In this regard, one is not terribly impressed by Mr. Nixon's advisors and, for that matter, his colleagues in recent months, because there seems to be a distressing attitude that if history some way gets in the way, the thing to do is either to ignore it or twist it in such a way that it serves your end. One example might be thrown out here at the outset. During the Watergate hearings, many of you will recall, Mr. Ehrlichman was on the stand, and Senator Talmadge was talking about the historic right of privacy and the protection against unreasonable search and seizure, and the concept that every man's home is his castle, particularly the concept of Pitt, the elder British statesman, who made very clear that this was a fundamental historical guarantee, making clear how important it was that the right of the individual should be protected against arbitrary power of the executive. And Mr. Ehrlichman, who at the time was casually and blithely defending the right to break into and burglarize Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, retorted, well, that old doctrine has certainly been considerably eroded over the years, has it not? This respect for history, I must say, distresses a professional historian very greatly. Further, in connection with various aspects of the preparation of the defense of Mr. Nixon by his attorneys, we again get some developments which I find are, in many respects, threatening and dangerous. Mr. St. Clair, whose name you know very well, prepared not too long ago a 61-page analysis of the constitutional standards which are supposed to be used in the forthcoming impeachment process. He winds up with a series of conclusions which I can only describe as remarkable, including such as the following, quotes, "The use of a predetermined criminal standard for the impeachment of a president is supported by history, logic, legal precedent, and a sound and sensible public policy which demands stability in our form of government." He goes on to say later in that long document that impeachment of a president should only be resorted to for cases of the gravest kind, and that the commission of a crime is essential before impeachment can even proceed. A president, he said, may only be impeached for indictable crimes, and again, history demonstrates that this is the case. He also indicates that the founding fathers meant, when they said treason, high crimes, and misdemeanors, solely criminal offenses, and wound up with a statement which still somewhat shakes me, that a broader interpretation would require lifting historical precedents out of context, disregarding the plain meaning and accepted definition of technical legal terms, and reading constitutional authorities selectively, which I would submit is exactly what Mr. St. Clair and his team did in preparing this absolutely remarkable and totally ahistorical document. We can possibly give slightly higher grades to the House Judiciary Committee, whose bipartisan team of lawyers did indeed prepare a 49-page advisory report somewhat on the same subject. I do think, in checking through their report, that their history is far more sound and that the conclusions that they come to are much more easily sustainable by the historical record. Three things that they stated, I think, are well worth our consideration. They indicate that limiting impeachable offenses to criminal conduct would be incompatible with the history of impeachment and the intent of the Constitution's authors, a position which I feel is justified. They argue also that the American experience with impeachment itself reflects the principle that impeachable conduct need not be criminal, and do a detailed analysis of the 13 impeachments which have occurred through American history, and wind up with an interesting statement in which they note that the Constitution really holds the president accountable when he takes office to the people in a variety of ways. And they state that among these ways are that he is under constitutional obligation to, quotes, take care that the laws be faithfully executed, unquotes, to faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States to the best of his ability. Clearly, they argue, if he is not carrying out his constitutional functions, it is really the House's responsibility to see why. If he clearly violates his constitutional oath or his constitutional obligations, it is up to the House to challenge him on those subjects. Again, suggesting, I think, very clearly, that the kind of behavior we are talking about need not in any respect be confined to criminal behavior. I'd like to look at one other aspect of this situation and give you some ideas of how, indeed, history has been twisted in the process. Let me take a particular point of law, a narrow one, but one in which I've done some detailed probing, and show you what has actually been happening in this area. Part of Mr. Nixon's defense rests upon a curiously circular argument that only indictable crimes are impeachable, or as Mr. St. Clair says, a president may only be impeached for indictable crimes, and then arguing that indictment must follow impeachment, which says that until you can prove that the president is susceptible to indictable crime, you can't impeach him, but you've got to impeach him before you indict him, which is a nice way, I must say, to get off the hook in the process. Now, historically speaking, I would submit that that argument has very little basis. But it is interesting, I think, to see how this particular position was developed. The Constitution makes fairly clear, Article 1, Section 3, Clause 7, if you like, chapter and verse, that the Senate shall have the power to try all impeachments. It goes on to say that judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to the removal from office, disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment. If you read that again fairly carefully, you will notice that the term nevertheless is used. In other words, he may be impeached, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, etc. But certainly there is no indication in that there is any sequence that is involved. Nevertheless, as a transition word, terms the subject to criminal indictment, but certainly does not suggest any order in the process. Moreover, this was carefully debated during the Constitutional Convention, and from what, again, we can tell from all of the record, any time the term nevertheless came in every draft that came before the convention, it was clear that this word was not in any sense being used in that fashion. How can you then build a case for the opposite? If you do look at the historic situation, you find that Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the early leaders of the Republic, would certainly have liked to have made impeachment prerequisite to indictment. In fact, he insisted that this should be argued. Further, Mr. Hamilton was at the Constitutional Convention, and toward the end of the convention, he handed to Mr. Madison a paper which he said he wished Madison would introduce. He then went off to New York in a bit of a huff and did not stay to participate in the final proceedings. Under Mr. Hamilton's suggestion, the president would have been elected for life. He would have been essentially of royal character. In fact, Hamilton uses the word abdicate in one section instead of resign. But in terms of the other problem, the immunity of the royal president from legal processes, Hamilton did agree that he could be impeached, and that impeachment, indeed, was a proper remedy. And if convicted, he argued, he should then be afterwards, quotes unquote, tried and punished in the ordinary course of law. The fact remains that historically none of this happened, and Hamilton's plan received no support in the Constitutional Convention, and his suggestion about sequence was rejected. Nonetheless, Mr. Hamilton was a hard loser, as you may recall, and Hamilton undertook, when he was writing the Federalist Papers a few years later, to try to slip into those what he had been unsuccessful in getting into the Constitution itself. So we read in Federalist Paper number 69 that the president is subject to impeachment and would afterwards be liable to prosecution and punishment in the ordinary course of law. Again, this is a misreading of the record and is certainly a corruption of what actually happened in Philadelphia. Okay, that I think historically can be justified. Yet let's see what happened when this got into the hands of White House lawyers. In the White House brief that was filed before the District Court, Washington, on August 7th of 1973, in connection with the Watergate tapes, Mr. Nixon's attorneys build a whole case on Hamilton's position. The president, states the brief, is liable to prosecution and punishment in the ordinary course of law for crimes he has committed, but only after he has been impeached, convicted, and removed from office. Three historical citations are given. Article 1, Section 3, which says nothing about after. Hamilton's misquoted statement from the Federalist, which again is totally out of context. And a dictum from a Supreme Court decision in 1838, Kendall versus the United States, which merely states the executive power is vested in a president, and so far as his powers are derived from the Constitution, he is beyond the reach of any other department, except in the mode prescribed by the Constitution through the impeachment power. That's, again, a hard one to use, I think, to defend this. However, apparently feeling that other historical evidence was necessary, the White House brief also quoted an argument made by Attorney General Henry Stanberry before the Supreme Court in the late 1860s in which he stated in good old Red Eagle oratory style, so long as the president is in office, he is above the process of any court except the quasi-court that tries impeachment. After he has been dealt with in that chamber and stripped of the robes of office so that he can no longer stand as the representative of the government, then for any wrong he has done by any individual, for any murder or any crime or any sort which he has committed as president, then and not till then can he be subjected to the jurisdiction of the courts. It's an interesting argument in some ways that the president, as long as he is in office, apparently can commit any kind of crime with complete abandon, and until he is impeached, he is completely scot-free. The whole art problem, however, with throwing this into this particular brief was that Mr. Stanbury's case was lost, and the court completely dismissed his argument in the process. The contention, then, that impeachment must precede indictment has again been put forward in recent days in another interesting episode. During the legal maneuvers preceding the resignation of Vice President Agnew, October of 1973, on September 25th, the former Vice President requested an inquiry by the House into charges that were being investigated by the District Court in Baltimore. And Mr. Agnew contended that the Constitution bars a criminal proceeding of any kind, federal or state, county or town, against a president or vice president when he holds office. Again, somewhat the same argument Mr. Stanbury had been making 100 years before. After the denial of this request and commencement of the presentation of evidence to the grand jury, Agnew's attorneys asked the U.S. District Court of Maryland to halt the grand jury proceedings on the grounds that the Constitution forbids that the vice president be indicted or tried in any criminal court. As a citation, they used Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Paper 69, which again has very little, if anything, to do with this point. The United States Department of Justice then took over. The Justice Department opposed Agnew's notion, and on October 5th, the Solicitor General, Mr. Bork, filed with the court a memorandum for the United States concerning the Vice President's claims of constitutional immunity, which argued that only the President is immune to indictment and criminal prosecution while in office. The memorandum makes two very interesting concessions. It first admits that the only explicit immunity in the Constitution is limited to congressmen, and moreover, that the natural inference is that no immunity exists where none is mentioned, both of which I agree with, and secondly, that the clause of the Constitution which provides that the party convicted is nonetheless subject to criminal punishment was intended not to establish the sequence of the two processes, but solely to establish that conviction upon impeachment does not raise a double jeopardy defense in the criminal trial. On the basis of this reading of the Constitution, the memorandum unhesitatingly asserts that it is clear that the framers and their contemporaries understood that lesser impeachable officers, that is, all except the president, are subject to criminal process. That's an interesting ruling also in many ways. Then the memorandum must tackle the formidable problem of establishing that the president is an exception, for which there is no historical basis, really, as near as anyone can see. No appeal to the written Constitution is really possible because the document does not in any instance give the president immunity in this area. So, lacking any historical base, lacking any legal base, what do you turn to? Well, obviously you turn to history and you find some precedents that you can use. Here were the precedents that were used. Hamilton's statement in Federal 69, the unreliability of which we've already discussed. An incidental statement from another of Hamilton's Federalist Papers, simply quoting what he said in 69. A statement on the same incident made by Gouverneur Morris, one of the founding fathers, which concludes, a conclusive reason for making the Senate instead of the Supreme Court the judge of impeachments was that the latter was to try the president after the trial of the impeachment. A similar statement from James Wilson, which says, pardon is necessary for cases of treason and is best placed in the hands of the executive. If he be himself a party to the guilt, he can be impeached and prosecuted. And I see nothing there speaking to immunity. And finally, a debate in the convention, July 20th, 1787, in which the question of making the president impeachable while in office was discussed, pro and con, with no conclusive result. Rarely, I submit, has an important constitutional doctrine been submitted by such flimsy historical evidence. And I would go on to say that it makes me angry because during the period of 6 months in which all of this legal defense was being afforded the president, $290,413 of our taxpayers' money was used to develop this kind of historical defense. Well, all right, this is an example of what I protest against. Let me look at, for just a few moments, of what I really feel is actually relevant, real history, honest history, to this situation. It seems to me that the real historical intent and purpose of the impeachment clause is not mysterious in any sense. One merely has to do a little historical research. State constitutions, before the federal constitution was adopted, all had impeachment clauses, which included a variety of charges, including such things as maladministration, corruption, or other means, that's from the Delaware Constitution, misconduct and maladministration in office, Massachusetts and New Hampshire Constitution, misdemeanor or default from the Connecticut Constitution. So again, the process is understood and the terms also are pretty clearly understood. As to its necessity in regard to the president, we get these statements from the founding fathers who were indeed putting all of this into the Constitution. George Mason, when great crimes are committed, I am for punishing the principal as well as the coadjutors. Shall any man be above justice? Above all, shall that man be above it who can commit the most extensive injustice? William R. Davy, a delegate from North Carolina, quotes, impeachment is an essential security for the good behavior of the executive. For if not impeachable while in office, he will spare no efforts or means whatever to get himself reelected. Edmund Randolph, impeachment is necessary because the executive would have great opportunities for the abuse of power, especially the power to wage war. James Madison, some provision should be made for defending the community against the incapacity, negligence, or perfidy of the chief magistrate. He might pervert his administration into a scheme of peculation, which is an old 18th century word meaning misappropriation of money, or oppression. Alexander Hamilton, in a different context, states the subject of impeachment jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they chiefly relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. The impeachment process was designed as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men. As to the definition of impeachable offenses, again, I think history is clear and the intent of the framers is equally clear. George Mason felt that treason and bribery would be too narrow and would not reach many great and dangerous offenses which ought to be impeachable, such as attempts to subvert the Constitution. He then proposed to add the term maladministration as an impeachable charge. Madison said, no, that's too vague a term. It would be equivalent to providing tenure during the pleasure of the Senate, and proposed, somewhat ironically, I think, the term other high crimes and misdemeanors, and the Constitution adopted the suggestion. The problem, of course, was that at the time, if you turn to Blackstone, who was the chief authority on English law, Blackstone defined other high crimes and misdemeanors as being maladministration in office. So we're back again to where we were before. There is also the kind of interesting question as to whether or not the president is responsible for the behavior of those who are beneath him. And here again, the fathers, I think, were perfectly clear. Mr. Madison, in discussing this particular question a few years later, turning around an event and a question of whether or not the president could and should be able to dismiss appointees without consent of the Senate, says, it may perhaps on some occasions be found necessary to impeach the president himself. Surely, therefore, it may happen to a subordinate officer whose bad actions may be connived at or overlooked by the president. I think it absolutely necessary that the president should have the power of removing appointees from office. It will make him in a peculiar manner responsible for their conduct and subject to impeachment himself if he suffers them to perpetuate with impunity high crimes or misdemeanors against the United States or neglects to superintend their conduct so as to check their excesses. On the constitutionality of the Declaration, I have no matter of doubt. When it comes also to the further question, really, of whether or not we can more precisely define impeachable crimes outside of the area of indictable crimes, here again, it seems to me, an important distinction needs to be drawn. Many people say, but if you're not going to charge the president with an indictable crime, what can you charge him with? You know, unpopular opinions, unpopular behavior? Is this merely a partisan matter? Is it merely, as Gerald Ford once said, a question of whether or not, you know, you can get enough votes in the House to be able to get the person out? I think it is not indeed at all this. And here again is one reason why Congress has a special obligation in this regard. Impeachment is really to deal with the irresponsible use of power. It does not mean using power in violation of constitutional restrictions. Both of those actions can be checked by the courts. The courts have perfectly good ways of handling this kind of an abuse. What we're really talking about, I think, is the abuse of discretionary authority, or the irresponsible use of discretionary authority. Here again, you have action which are not justiciable, that is, to which the courts cannot themselves find ways to check. In this respect, certainly, it is not so difficult, I think, to define really what is irresponsible abuse of discretionary authority. My parting shot would simply be this. The time of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, there was taking place in England one of the most historic trials of the latter years, certainly of the 18th century, the trial of Warren Hastings, who was a British civil servant who had served in India and who had been brought back to England and was charged really with just exactly this, irresponsible abuse of discretionary authority. In the process of this trial, the information of which came very clearly to the Founding Fathers and which they read with great interest, Edmund Burke, who was, after all, a highly conservative English leader of the time, made several statements which I know the Founding Fathers read since it turns up basically in their writing and letters. Mr. Burke said, it is by this tribunal, meaning Parliament, that statesmen who abuse their power are accused by statesmen, not upon the niceties of a narrow jurisprudence, but upon the enlarged and solid principles of state morality. It is here that those who by the abuse of power have violated the spirit of law can never hope for protection from any of its forms. It is here that those who have refused to conform themselves to its perfections can never hope to escape through any of its defects. And I think there's really no reason to shrink from that particular position. The power to impeach a faithless minister was not, to Burke, a dangerous power. It was absolutely an essential power. In fact, in Mr. Burke's words, it was the great guardian of the purity of the Constitution itself. I submit, then, that we really need to get back in this country to some of those historic first principles, that impeachment is the historic and proper route to take, and that if good history is turned to as the guide, not twisted law office history, we can begin getting our constitutional machinery and hopefully our nation generally functioning properly again.
That was Professor Paul Murphy of the University of Minnesota Department of History. Taking the view that historical precedent was not relevant to the Nixon situation was Yale Law School professor Clyde W. Summers.
If I understand Professor Murphy's point correctly, it is that bad history provides misguidance, good history provides guidance. The question, I suppose, then remains, whose history is the good history and whose history is the bad history? Now, I realize that this is a matter that's easy for historians to resolve in view of the fact that they do not, these days, turn out any controversial works. It's all perfectly agreed. I would say that from a lawyer's standpoint, and in a sense we're talking about a legal problem, though not much of a legal problem in legal terms, that I think that the criticism of the president's lawyers and Mr. St. Clair is to some degree misdirected in that what is being criticized is that these men are behaving just like lawyers and just like good lawyers. That is, they are serving as advocates and not as scholars. They're being paid to defend man, not to find the truth. And in that respect, it seems to me, they are behaving in the best way possible for a lawyer, given the assignment and the professional responsibility with which they're charged. Now, the question might come, why is there this resort to history? Why is it that Mr. St. Clair and the president's lawyers began to go back and prove their case by appeals to history, and as Professor Murphy says, distorting history, twisting it? And all I want to make clear is that if the question is choosing between Mr. St. Clair's history and Professor Murphy's history, I have no doubt about who's correct. And that is, I think that Mr. St. Clair is an excellent lawyer, but a poor historian. But in any case, why the appeal to history given this situation? For it must be quite clear that the historical material really is quite scanty. It really is quite long ago. It really does not respond directly to our problems. Why the resort to history? Well, particularly why does Mr. St. Clair resort to history when the history is all against him? I would suggest that there are two reasons. In the first place, the appeal to history as a method of justifying a conclusion to which one is compelled to come, having accepted a particular side for client, that appeal to history is because it provides a kind of a disguise for an advocate's presentation of a point of view, as if it were not simply the advocate's point of view or the point of view he is paid to present. It provides a kind of an appearance of detachment, as if there were no independent judgment being exercised. And the appeal to historical documents gives one the feeling that somehow they are rediscovering the tablets handed down from Mount Sinai, and therefore they know now what is the truth to be applied in this day. Well, I suppose if in the caves of Palestine we could find the proper papyrus rolls to find out what the ancient truth was, we might find more security for our solutions to our problems, at least if they agreed with us. But I would suggest that we are here confronted with a very serious problem. It's not Mr. Madison's problem. It's not Mr. Randolph's problem. It's not Mr. Hamilton's problem. It's our problem. And our problem is for us to solve, and it is for us to solve with as much sense and sensibility as we can. And therefore, we ought to confront it as a problem and ask ourselves, what is the best solution, given the most of the judgment and wisdom we can muster for the occasion? Now, I would suggest that if we approach the problems in that fashion, we might find that the answers are much simpler than one would find in some circumstances from history. In some circumstances, on some problems, we might find they are much more difficult. Indeed, unresolvable in terms of real security, that we know for sure what we are doing, but with a sense of having thought it through, having committed to a position and a thing that must be done, to go ahead and do it with the best of judgment we have. Let me take, for example, one problem which Professor Murphy mentions, and that is, can you indict a president before you impeach him? Well, if you read the words of the Constitution, they will leave you a bit up in the air, even when you go back to ask what the historical meaning of those words might have been nearly 200 years ago now. If you go back to trace the history otherwise, you may find some conflicting evidence, come to a particular conclusion. But I would suggest there is another way of solving that problem, and I don't find it a difficult problem at all. Shall we indict a president while he sits as a president? Then what happens? If he's indicted, he shall be tried. If he is to be tried, where shall he be tried? Of course, in a courtroom. And who shall be the ones who sit in determination of whether he has committed a crime? 12 jurymen who have been selected because they don't know anything about any of the problems. Indeed, if we are taking the Mitchell Stans trial, the major portion of the jurors in the Mitchell Stans trial didn't even know who Mr. Mitchell and who Mr. Stans were. I suppose that we can find jurymen who may not even know who Mr. Nixon is, though that might not. But now suppose you choose your 12 men tried and true, a jury of his peers. That's the common law phrase. I don't know what that leads you to. But now just imagine. Now just imagine. You're going to sit in a courtroom and 12 common citizens are going to sit and pass on whether a man shall be removed from the presidency of the United States. Is that the way you want to make the decision? Pick 12 people off the street and make the most momentous decision that the country can make. People chosen at random for their non-knowledge, for their lack of conviction or interest in the problem. I submit to you, you don't need history to answer that question. You don't indict a president until after you impeach him, because you couldn't tolerate the results which it would otherwise lead you to. And if the people who drafted the Constitution had some different idea, it's because they don't know our present problems and couldn't know them. Let's take another example. Can you impeach a president for non-criminal conduct? Must there be crimes, an indictable offense? Now, you can go back and trace the history, and when I trace the history, I arrive at where Professor Murphy does. Historically, there was no notion that it had to be an indictable offense. And the term high crimes and misdemeanors was a term that came out of a total different setting than criminal law as we know it. But I suggest that we can answer that question quite simply. Is the test whether it's an indictable crime? Well, first let me say all you have to do is look at the United States Criminal Code and see how many things are crimes, how easy it is to commit a crime, how multitude they are, how sometimes inconsequential they are, how sometimes technical they are, and you have the feeling the fact that a man's committed an indictable offense is no standard as to whether he should be removed as president. For there are, of course, indictable offenses that we would be out of our mind to remove a president for committing, if that's all he'd done. Take manslaughter, for example, with reckless operation of an automobile. Suppose we had a president who drove his own. And he speeds, as President Johnson did. And instead of hitting a cow, he hits a child. So it's an indictable offense. You're going to throw him out of office? I would suggest that's not the test. Let's look at it from the other side. Let's suppose that the president announces that he's not going to enforce the Civil Rights Act. Congress can pass all the Civil Rights Acts they want, but he won't enforce them. I don't know that that's an indictable offense, but I have no doubt that a president who did that ought to be removed from office. Suppose a president announces that any of his appointees, he announces it in advance, that any of his appointees who are convicted of a crime, he will pardon them come the next Christmas. I don't know that that's a crime. I don't have to know whether that's a crime. Such a president, it seems to me, needs to be removed. Well, I could go on and on it seems to me that any person with about 5 minutes reflection can themselves make a catalog of at least a half a dozen reasons for which a president might be removed from office which are not indictable offenses. And it seems to me that we don't need history to answer those questions. Then comes the question, well, how shall we know what is an impeachable offense? How shall we know whether to impeach a president? And I think we have to look at it in terms of the setting of our time, not the setting of 175 years ago. We have to see it in the context of our governmental structure, not the governmental structure as it was envisioned by men who had not yet even seen the first day of its operation, but could only project into the future how they thought it might work when the time came. Let me suggest that at the root of the problem of impeachment is a very fundamental governmental problem, which we have to confront to satisfy ourselves, and when we do, what has to be done? We'll know we did the right thing. At the root of the problem is a doctrine of separation of powers. Not just separation of powers, because the separation of powers has as its corollary the principle of checks and balances. Three departments of government, to a degree independent, but to a degree checked by each other. That means that one of the values, one of the concerns, must be the preservation of the presidency as an institution of government, effective, capable of standing on its own, serving its purpose as a viable, independent branch of government. So that we must be concerned that we do not turn the instrument of impeachment into a device to convert what is essentially a presidential, legislative, executive division of government into essentially a parliamentary type of government in which presidents are removed simply because they have lost their political appeal or are confronted by a Congress which is against them. On the other hand, we have to be concerned that the president and the presidency is subject to the checks intended by the Constitution, so that with its independence, with its role as a fundamental instrument of government, it is still not beyond being checked whenever it goes astray. There are various checks which are available, of course. Congress can override a presidential veto. Congress has the power of the purse. But there are some things that presidents may do, I think has done, which are not subject to those kinds of checks, and so there is the ultimate instrument designed as a check by Congress on the president, and that is impeachment. And so we're caught with this problem of preserving the independence of the presidency as a viable third part of the government, but yet making that subject to a congressional check. And that's a hard balance to strike. That's a hard judgment to make. And from the historical standpoint, let me suggest that we ought to consider certain things in which things have now changed to a degree which may change the character of our judgment on this. First, it seems to me we must take into account that the powers and the status of the president have greatly changed in the 175 years. The president now has an enormous amount of power, much greater than ever conceived by the drafters of the Constitution. Much of this power is necessary because of the functions government carries out, the necessity for the president to exercise control over the administration, to execute the laws, to get the job done. But as a part of that increased power of the president has accumulated devices which enable him to influence congressional action by deciding where to spend money, by deciding how to do certain things, by passing out favors to congressmen and various other things. So that the president has accumulated power, not only power generally, but power over the Congress to a degree. The increase of power has given him an increased potential for abuse of power, which means we must, to a certain degree, be more careful about how a president behaves now than 175 years ago, because the president then did not have the potentiality for abuse. And that whenever there is the potential for the abuse of power, there then comes to the people a sense of fear that power will be abused, and as a consequence, we may have more need now than we have had in the past for a sense of confidence in the people that when power is vested in a man, this kind of power, that it will not be abused, that we need not even look closely for the assurance that it has not been abused. Let me suggest also a difference in the character of the presidency, and that is, particularly in the last 20 years, the increased sense of the presidency as symbolic in our structure of government and in our society. To a certain extent, this was curried by the language, the myths of Camelot. It was perpetuated by the appeals to the presidency and the institution of the presidency of the present incumbent. But what is true, regardless of its source, is that the president stands as a symbol in our society. He stands, I think, and is considered to stand by many people as symbolizing a kind of political, moral, nearly spiritual leadership to which we look, or we would like to look. To a certain extent, we are tempted, and I think there is much in our society that wants to look to a president and tends to look to a president as symbolizing what we hope is the best in us. And because we have created this symbol, or it has come upon us, and this sense of the symbol of the presidency, it means that we have a stake in the maintaining of that symbol to serve the purpose, to provide that kind of purpose rather than the opposite. Let me suggest a second change in the situation, and that is we must take into account that in 175 years, government itself has grown much larger, much more pervasive, encompassing, touching, controlling much more of our lives. This means, it seems to me, that if our society is to hold together, if government is to perform what we want it to perform, then there must be a very deep and abiding sense of confidence in the government, a credibility in the government, a sense that the government can be trusted. As we increasingly come in a complex society to problems that only government can solve, that private activity cannot solve. If we only think of the more immediate ones, of environment, of pollution, of energy crisis, these are things that private parties cannot solve. Government must solve them, or they will not be solved. And the potential for abuse, as we know it now in government, is less from the bad laws it passes than the good laws which it maladministers. For what are the nature of the abuses? They are the giving of small business loans to help people engage in competition, but favoring those who are the political friends. It is the matter of denying privileges, jobs, positions, government contracts to those who do not provide political support. It is the potentialities for spying, for eavesdropping. The problems of our government in terms of its potential abuse as government gets larger is less in the laws which Congress passes than in the administration of the laws charged to the President of the United States. The impeachment process itself is the last desperate way. Can you imagine what we now confront? Month or 2 months of hearings by a committee, debate in the House of Congress, months of trial before a Senate, and if you think that trial before the Senate can be completed before January, you are an optimist. And it seems to me for that reason we must weigh carefully what we are about before we enter. Lest after we enter, we begin to feel we may have been wrong. When the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, it seems to me from reading history, and I know I'm not supposed to look back to history tonight, but it does seem to me they had a rather casual notion about impeachment. Well, if the President gets out of line, the House votes and the Senate has a trial and you're done with him, a week or two. You know, even with President Johnson, it didn't take very long. It was a very simple case. As a matter of fact, for practical purposes, he pled guilty and just claimed that the statute he was charged with violating was unconstitutional. He didn't need witnesses for that. They had some. Well, it's not that kind of a simple thing in our day, in our time, in our circumstance. The desperateness of the device of impeachment is matched, in my judgment, by the desperateness of the situation. For the fundamental principle which we are concerned about is the preservation of the institutions of government, of having three viable branches of government. It is perfectly clear that at the present time, one branch of government is not viable. The presidency, for the time being, as an institution of government, has been destroyed. It no longer exists as an operating institution of government. It is no more now than a defense table built into the White House. The executive branch is paralyzed. And it is paralyzed not because it has been attacked, but because it has been vulgarized. It has been abused. It has been misused. And in such a gross fashion that scarcely a person in the United States can fail to recognize it. And it no longer exists as a working instrument of government. And in my judgment, there is no way of restoring the presidency, even as an operating institution, than to change the name of the man who heads it. And for that purpose, I would say almost any name would do. But notice beyond that, if the presidency is to be a symbol, what has the presidency become a symbol of? Not the best of us. Not what we would like ourselves to think we would like to be or want to be or hope to be. It has come to represent the worst that we feared we might become. It has come to be the epitome, the activation of political corruption, vulgarity, misuse. We no longer have that symbol. That too has been destroyed. If there is not impeachment, in my judgment, the alternative, the consequence then will be to destroy the second branch of government as an effective check, and that is to, will be a confession that Congress lacks the capacity to serve its constitutional function of maintaining a check on the presidency. The only way to save the structure of government as we know it, in even its formal sense, it seems to me, is that Congress must discharge its constitutional responsibility. The only last resort, the only way of correcting the situation, and by the replacement of the president, have both a presidency and a legislative branch that can deserve and claim the respect of the society. There is no way to restore that credibility and confidence short of taking the desperate action that is required. For what shall we say of ourselves? What shall we say of our government? What shall we claim for our processes if, having seen what we have seen, we say we are unequal to the task of doing that which is necessary to declare that the government shall deserve respect? To some extent, one might say that the failure of the president to pay his income taxes is a rather minor sort. It's a large amount, but that's just because he's managed to accumulate a lot of money. And I suppose, to a certain degree, we sometimes think, well, maybe we wish we could get away with that much on our income tax. But notice what is involved. President doesn't pay his income taxes. How can the government expect the largest, most fruitful, self-assessed tax system in the world to continue to function? Why should anybody feel an obligation to pay their taxes if the president does not? If the president's agent can commit fraud by misdating a deed. They only missed it a year and a month. Strange, they only needed to miss it by a year. But if nothing is done about that, then where shall we have confidence in government? How can government perform its function? I would only say, it is from this standpoint, it seems to me, that the appeals to history are lawyers' arguments. They are lawyers' arguments meant to match each other, partly because of some sense of appeal to them. It seems to me our problems are too serious to look backward to history. Somebody defined me once, a historian, was a dead duck flying backwards. I think the description of the duck being dead is a little inappropriate. But we don't need to look to history to know what to do. Our problems are today, and it seems to me you ought to measure the gravity of our problems today. And if we make a judgment of what we must do to make our system function for the next 20, 50, 100 years, it seems to me there is no question of what must be done.
Yale Law School Professor Clyde W. Summers, in a debate with Professor Paul Murphy at the University of Minnesota last week.